And then we'll start the recording in a minute. Recording this computer. Okay, here we go. Shavua Tov, Baruch HaTzibat Tova. Thanks everyone for joining me on this Motzei Shabbos. I realize that it's a little bit soon after Shabbos, but I wanted to make sure that I don't keep anybody up too late tonight. People want to rest up for Yom Kippur. Some of us have early bedtimes. Some of us should have early bedtimes. So thanks for joining with me soon after Shabbos. I'll start by saying that as I'm going to sort of address things related to the past and future of this virus, if there's one thing that all rabbis want to know, it's that if we're going to have to start shaking hands with 200 people a day after all this is over, that's a big question that we're probably all thinking about. So I say that in jest, and of course, the irony of what I'm going to be talking about is that I'm sharing this over Zoom and not to a live audience, and I can't tell if anybody laughed at the joke. But the title of this drasha is Hashivenu Hashem Elecha V'Nashuva, return us to you Hashem and we will return, reflecting on the outcomes of COVID-19. So the first thing I should say is that COVID is not over. And there's a few things that I mean by that, but one thing, of course, that I want to make 100% clear is that when I talk about outcomes, I'm not talking about knowing exactly what the future is going to hold. And really, we don't necessarily know everything about what's going to have come as a result of this tkufa, this period that we're in. But nonetheless, this is really, I think, a time for us to be doing a cheshbon hanefesh. The Ramah says in Shulchan Aruch, during a series of mitzvah, v'yesh l'chol adam l'chapes u'fafesh b'ma'asav, person should look inward, should search in themselves, v'lashuv mehem b'aseres yimei tshuva, and a person should do tshuva during a series of mitzvah. So this is the time for us to be looking at that, and that itself could be the gist of any sort of Shabbos Shuva drasha. That's time for us to look inward and to think about where we are, where we went this past year, where we're going, and to do tshuva. But as it relates to the current theme, while I wouldn't expend too much effort on a daily basis or even a weekly basis thinking about, you know, what's the past and what's the future of the world, and maybe we do that naturally, but I wouldn't necessarily set out to do that in the shir, if there's any time to look for a musar from this time, from what has transpired, I think it is now. And the two basic questions, nothing too profound, but two really basic questions that we have to think about, we have to give a lot of thought to, is what have we learned and where are we going? And these two, I would suggest, are connected, and I'll show how they are connected, I hope. So in this vein, my goal tonight is really just to share some thoughts. And I have to admit, a lot of Shabbos Tshuva drushas are really shiurim, and I often do give a shiur in the slots, but tonight I'm not really looking to do any sort of fancy lundus, to really look heavily into deep sources, but I just want to speak a little bit straight tonight. With some Divrei Torah, of course, grounding the whole endeavor, but there's not necessarily a fancy chop that I'm looking to give, but I think it's just, if this is a time to do a cheshbon hanefesh, then that's what I want to talk about. And I think now, a lot of Rabbanim, I think, have done that at some point over the last number of months. I think now is the time that I really want to do that. a certain sense, I'm going to ask in advance for everybody's forgiveness that this Yamim Noraim season has not been simple in the slightest. So I hope that what I say tonight will be valuable and meaningful. But if it falls short in any way, if it's not necessarily, again, as fancy or intellectually creative of a drasha, then I ask for your forgiveness. And I'm also going to note that if you look at the packet of drashas that were distributed, I didn't write every drasha about COVID. Tomorrow night, I don't think, between Kol Nidre and Maariv, I don't think I'm going to be talking about COVID, because I think there are other things to be thinking about. There's still normal life, not normal life, but there's still a bit of life that we have to live outside of the pandemic. But with that said, I think it's important now to talk about that a little bit. And part of how I want to frame our discussion for tonight is about individual versus communal tshuva. And both are important. In some ways, it's easier to do tshuva as an individual, and I emphasize easier because there's no true tshuva that can really be said to be easy. But when it comes to individual tshuva, I'm the balbas. I know myself better than anyone else, and therefore it's in my hands to change if I want to make a change. And Rambam emphasizes that we all have rishus, we all have the ability to choose whether we want to be a tzaddik or a rasha. So when it comes to myself, I have most of the ability to do that. When it comes to communal tshuva, it can be very hard to address that and to talk about what it means to change, because it's not necessarily just dependent on me. I might think that whatever is going on, it's not me. I'm a little powerless. But the Rambam dispels this notion in Hilchos Tshuva. If you look at Perek Gimel Halacha Dalet, so it starts in a way that is very famous to all of us. It says, Afa Pishit Kiya Shofar Rosh Hashanah Gzeres HaKasev, even though blowing shofar is a degree of the Torah, Remez Yeshbo, there's a hint to it, Klomar, Uru Yusheni Mishenachlam, wake up from your sleep, and your Dami Markitz Mitari Matchlam, those who are falling asleep, those who are sleeping, wake up from your slumber. V'chipsu b'maseichem, search, look at your actions. V'chizra b'tshuva v'zichru borachem, and remember your creator, do tshuva, etc. This idea of the shofar being the proverbial alarm clock is very familiar to us. And it goes on a little bit elaborating on this point, but it's really the next part of this Rambam that I want to focus on. He says, V'fichach tzarich kol adam, person has to see themselves the entire year, A person should see themselves as being half innocent, half guilty. And same too with the whole world, we are half innocent and we are half guilty. And I think many people are aware of the idea that each action we do can tip the scales in one way or another for ourselves. But in fact, the Gemara does reflect that we, each individual, have the ability to do this for the whole world. So I'm not powerless, I'm not independent, I'm not just one person, but I can affect the balance of the whole world. If a person sinned once, not only did I tip the scales for myself if I sinned once, but I tip the scales for the whole world. And a person can cause destruction for the whole world. On the other hand, asa mitzvah achas, harei hichriyas atzmo v'eskol ha'olam kulo l'kaf zchus. But if I do a mitzvah, not only have I tipped the scales in my favor for myself, but I've done it for the entire world as well. Begaram lo v'lahem tshuva v'atzala, and you cause salvation. Shenamar v'tzadik yisod olam, a tzadik, a righteous person, is the foundation of the entire world. Because one person tipped the scales in favor of the world and saved it. And therefore, the whole Jewish people have the custom of the Harbos Bitstaka to do a lot of staka, masim tovim, lasok be mitzvos, and to do a lot of mitzvos from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, more so than the rest of the year. So what do we see from this Rambam? Again, we tend to focus on this idea that the shofar is the alarm clock, but really what do these two things have to do with each other? So the shofar wakes us up, and therefore we have to think about the fact that we're half innocent and half guilty. But right now, we see so strongly, here in 2020, going from 5780 to 5781, we see how much one person's actions at one particular moment matters. And what the Rambam's telling us here is to wake up, and not just as individuals, not just because I have to do tshuva for myself, but because there's a concept of communal tshuva, and each one of us is involved in that. It's not some sort of amorphous collective, but each one of us are part of that collective. And that's part of what I want to discuss when we talk about Shiveinu Hashem Elecha Nashuva. It's plural, it's collective. When we talk about wanting to return to Hashem, it's a collective activity. So the question we have to ask is, how have we woken up? And what will, perhaps, what directions are we going to take in the future? So I'm going to highlight three particular areas tonight that I want us to think about. There's probably a lot more that could be said. I could be here for several hours probably discussing these points. But I'm going to focus on three ideas. And the first one is the idea of arevut, of responsibility, of being part of a collective. We know the principle that we're all responsible for each other, but interestingly, it's shofar that's a paradigmatic example of the mitzvah where arevut applies. Because it's in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that brings up a writer that says, Tani Ava Breit de Rabbi Zera, Kol HaBrachos Kulam, when it comes to all brachos, even though I fulfill my obligation, I can still perform it on behalf of others. This excludes food. So if I ate bread, I drank wine, so I can't do that for somebody else. But when it comes to other mitzvahs, even if I already did it, I can discharge somebody else of their obligation, even though I've already fulfilled the mitzvah. You might think that I can't do it for them because I've already checked off, so I have a lower level or no obligation anymore. But in fact, I can do it for somebody else. And this is brought in the context of the Gemara Rosh Hashanah when it's talking about shofar, which we just blew. We had a shofar blowing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. And the person who blew shofar had already fulfilled the mitzvah of shofar. And yet he had the ability to discharge 40 other people of their obligation to hear shofar. In Rashi, in this Gemara, says, Alpha Pisha Yatza Motzi, even though I already fulfilled my obligation, I can discharge the obligation of others. Sharei Kol Yisrael Arevin Ze Baze La Mitzvot. All of Israel is responsible for one another when it comes to mitzvot. And this is a familiar Rashi, a familiar idea. Here, of course, he brings up in the concept of mitzvot. Sometimes we take off the mitzvot's part and we talk about our collective responsibility regardless. But nonetheless, we have this idea of arevus that I am responsible for helping other people when I have the ability to. And it's not just the rabbis, it's not just the presidents and vice presidents and the people with the titles, but Kol Yisrael, everybody. That we're supposed to help others accomplish mitzvot. And that's what we did the past few months. We did help others accomplish mitzvot. And we helped others meet their basic needs over the last few months. Whether it was going grocery shopping for people, there was some point before Pesach that I got a request for somebody to pick up medication from a pharmacy, and it was arranged. So one thing that we learned from the past few months is the importance of helping each other out. That when we're not in the conventional situation, when we weren't able to do things in shul, that we made sure that people had what they needed to make Shabbos, that we made sure that people had the ability to know how to do Pesach, to be able to say Yisker when we weren't doing it in shul. So we did this in the realm of mitzvos. And we certainly learn that this is true when it comes to health and life itself as well. Because as we all know, the reason why we wear masks in public is not to protect ourselves, but it's to protect others. And sometimes there's a part of us that, because we're hyper aware, and if we're hypersensitive and we're protective, so we might feel like we're in a particular environment and, oh, I need to put my mask on, I want to be careful around, I'm a little scared what it might be about. But the truth is, it's actually specifically not what we do that affects our own health and safety when we're in public, but it's what other people are doing. If I'm wearing a mask and nobody else is, it doesn't do very much good. We wear masks to protect ourselves. And social distancing also is not something that I necessarily have full control over. Somebody comes and walks in my direction, I don't have control. But we do social distancing in order to protect others. And doing both of these things, keeping our distance and wearing a mask, is a sign of respecting personal space, which is, by the way, something that in general, even before the pandemic, we needed a little bit more of. We needed to learn a little bit more about respecting people's personal space. And each shul and each school can only operate with everybody's cooperation, whether that's inside the building or even outside the building. We can't control what people do on their own. But whatever choices people are making on a day-to-day basis, even if once somebody's outside the shul building, we can't force them to wear a mask or to keep social distance. But the truth is, we all know, we are all aware that what we do anywhere we go affects everybody that we come in contact with at every point. And this is our reboot. This is what we've learned. I hope one of the big lessons that we've learned is the importance of looking out for each other, that we're all responsible, that it depends on all of us together. That, as the Rambam said, that one particular action that I take can affect the balance of a whole community. One person showing up in a space, sometimes they might not even realize it, but a whole community can be quarantined. If one person shows up in a particular space positive, whether it was intentional or not, we've learned the importance of responsibility. And of course, we've seen this when it comes to chesed as well, the way we've learned to help each other out, to call each other, to call those who are in need of chizuk, to call those who are alone, to help everybody make sure they have their needs. I believe Arivut is one of the biggest lessons that we've had to pay attention to the last 6 months. Another area that I think is focusing on during Shabbos Shuva is the realm of leadership. Because again, what we've experienced the last 6 months has very little to do with, on the one hand, it has a lot to do with what I as an individual do, but I alone as an individual am not the whole collective. And there needs to be somebody with vision, whether it's for the whole country or whether it's for one particular community, there needs to be people of vision who are able to coordinate responses, who are able to keep everybody together, united, and doing the right thing during this time. And I want to reflect on leadership in really two aspects. Number one is the role of postgame. Postgame matter for two reasons, particularly during this time. Number one, even if somebody is knowledgeable in halacha, even if a rabbi knows the things that they need to know to run a community in normal times, there are a lot of questions that come up that are not entirely normal, that we never necessarily thought of. We didn't pay attention to that particular halacha or that particular gemara. We don't even know how to apply it because there's just so many different factors to think about and to research. And we might not necessarily feel entirely equipped to do that. But there are such individuals who really have the entire Torah at their fingertips, and they have the ability to help us navigate those questions. And indeed, many did. And the additional factor that makes poskim important is that it's important for unity, for having shared language, that especially as we're an increasingly global community, that if everybody does what they think is right, everybody does something on their own, acts on their own, then there's no standard of practice and can be very hard to figure out what's right, what's wrong, what's the way to go. And this is true in general, but this is especially true when it came to COVID, that what one rav decides is not only precedent for their own community, but for that of others. Because people start to look at, they're doing this there, and they're doing, and another community is doing this, and maybe we should do this as well. So this is something that we've seen especially during the pandemic, that when we can look around and we can see a standard for practice, and we can see some uniform standards, it makes it much easier for communities at large to do the right thing. So this isn't just about how hard a particular sugya is. It's not just about how unique the question is, but it's about what is wise policy to be replicated. What are the implications if one chol, if one community does this? How does that affect others and the choices they make? And of course, every community is different, and there's still supposed to be room for a communal rabbi based on knowledge of his own community to make the decisions. In fact, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, when he was asked about questions about how to do Hoshanas and Simchas Torah, so he said, I don't want to paskin there because every community is going to be different, and what's right in one place is not right in another place. But yeah, we've also seen that with so many, in an environment that's so precarious and with so many sfeikot, with so many different uncertainties for how we should go about, having sort of a communal leadership and a direction for us to be able to say, we know that we can rely on this approach and something that we can all unite around, I believe that's very powerful. We've had such leaders from YU, from Official Schechter, from Rabbi Mordechai Willick, who have been both very helpful in terms of Pesach Halacha, but also in their own personal role modeling and the way that they've acted in public during the pandemic. In Eretz Yisrael, you have the example of Rav Asher Weiss, and there are many others, but all are examples of individuals who, when we had questions, what's the right thing to do? What's the way we should go right now? They were able to provide sound guidance based on expert medical opinions and a real understanding of the reality of what's going on. If I could perhaps share one particular thing that speaks to me right now, this was a sukkah decoration that I saw yesterday. Picture of a number of Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Schechter, Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Mordechai Willig, and Rav Rosenzweig, Rosh Yeshiva from Shivat Har Tzion. Some people put up pictures of Gedolim in their sukkahs. And yet, these are example of Talmidei Chachamim wearing masks. And they do it everywhere they go. It's not a charade. But they are true role models, not only for what it means to be an Eved Hashem, but what also means to be a human being and to do the right thing and to look out for Pikuach Nefesh. And for me, that's been a very inspiring part of this whole situation, that we've had leaders that we can not only trust their knowledge, but we know that they're walking the walk and that they're doing their best to keep us safe, but also connected to Avodas Hashem during this time. So I think one thing that for me has been a takeaway during this time is the importance of having leaders in the world of halacha who can give us a path to go by and could be good practitioners and role models of it as well. There's also the general sense of leadership that's important, because forget halacha for a second, but really with everything related to COVID, I think one thing that's clear to me is that everybody knows that they are an expert based on what they read and based on the conversations that they have had with their friends. We have all declared ourselves experts from reading the news or watching the news and watching social media. We know exactly what the right way and the wrong thing to do is. And it's either that the government is too loose, too restrictive, the people around us are being too restrictive, too loose, and we all know, seem to know exactly what's right. And the worst part about this is there's this new phenomenon called social media influencers. I feel a little bit old because when I first heard this idea of being an influencer, and I'm like, what does that even mean? But I Googled this. A social media influencer is a user who has established credibility in a specific industry, has access to a huge audience, and can persuade others to act based on their recommendations. Okay, so if you're on Instagram, that's the platform where people post pictures and videos. And if you're like a famous public figure, celebrity, whatever, so you might have tens of thousands of followers. So you have the bully pulpit to say whatever you want. So they here in this definition say that it's established credibility in a specific industry. But people definitely don't limit themselves to their own expertise, but they'll comment on whatever they want to comment on politically or whatever has to do with COVID. And of course, by the way, I am also guilty of at points thinking that that I know a lot and my own expertise. I've done this during COVID. And perhaps there's an element of me getting up and sharing my opinions that itself is hubris, although that is, I guess, perhaps part of my job is to share my thoughts and opinions. But there's a difference, again, between people knowing what their expertise is, knowing what their limitations is, and people getting up and using their audiences to talk about things that they have absolutely no expertise in. And so I'm going to talk about this now. I'll give you one example. Before going to bed on Thursday night, Eliana was watching this woman on Instagram. She's a food blogger of sorts, and she's some sort of coach, life coach or something as well. She has something like 30,000 followers. And she starts going on a whole rant about the Department of Health standards, of how school is closing, and you know, the first thing I heard was that you know, they can't just close schools that are open and doing the right things even if they have cases. So my response to that is, well, they did that in March, and if they have to do it now again, then they'll do it again. But she goes on ranting about the Department of Health and the decisions they're making, and what schools should and shouldn't be doing. And my response to that is that that's not your expertise. You have 30,000 followers. Okay, so you want to give your opinion, but to 30,000 people who are following you, there's a real hazard here that people can be making responsible and irresponsible decisions based on their own intuition, based on hearing what their influencers that they like, that they're following, have to say. And there's a difference between that and asking people who have the expertise in that area. Okay. And of course, it's important to have leadership when it comes to medical advice, that at the end of the day, who should be our leaders in this area? It should be people with medical expertise. So, you know, we sometimes fall short. We're not always good about, I think it's safe to say that many people are not always good about flossing. We maybe don't wash our hands as often as we should or as long as we should. But I think one thing that we've learned from COVID is the importance of real leadership, to listen to people who know what they're talking about, people who are going to make the right decisions. And even though, obviously, when we look back in March, consensus changed a number of times because at the end of the day, we were dealing with something new. And look here, by 2020 and we expect instant gratification and that with the seven of my fingers, I can have whatever information or whatever things that I want. But obviously it took time to understand this a little better to get it right. But the importance of having sound leadership that is thinking of the big picture, even if it's an inconvenience to many, but looking at the big picture, what's ultimately going to keep us all safe, listening to the right municipal leaders, federal leaders, medical experts, I think is something that's very important, that whether it's halacha, whether it's medicine, social policy or whatnot, we need good leadership. Okay, so that was thing number two. And the third thing that I think we've come away with from COVID, of course, is an appreciation of the importance of shul. So I'll read you a quote from Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. It's been widely shared during this time, although I don't think I've shared it yet. So if you've heard it already, I apologize. But anybody who hears this finds it jarring, and yet its resurgence during COVID makes it quite prophetic. He said, if I had the power, I'd provisionally close all synagogues for 100 years. So Mirza Hashem, shuls are not being closed for 100 years because of COVID. But Rehersh is saying, I would provisionally close all synagogues for 100 years. Do not tremble at the thought of it, Jewish heart. What would happen? Jews and Jewesses without synagogues desiring to remain such would be forced to concentrate on a Jewish life in a Jewish home. The Jewish officials connected with the synagogue would have to look to the opportunity now open to them to teach young and old how to live a Jewish life and how to build a Jewish home. All synagogues closed by Jewish hands would constitute the strongest protest against the abandonment of the Torah in home and life. Obviously, he's responding to a concern, a phenomenon that people were doing Judaism shul, but then when they go home, it's something else. That I'm religious at the synagogue, but on the streets, I'm not. And in fact, during this time, instead of Rav Hirsch closing the shuls, shuls had to close on their own due to the situation. And we turned our homes into shuls in Bate Midrash. Anybody who's been in my living room, and if you haven't, then I hope in the near future when this is all over, I hope that we'll have the opportunity to have you over soon. But if you look at my living room, so we have these bookshelves lined up against the left wall when you walk in. And there's like a little bit of a cabinet behind the couch. I don't know if you can picture it, but if you've been inside, you know what I'm talking about. And at some point I just decided, you know what? The Sfarim in the background make a good background when I'm giving shiurim, when I'm teaching. It's better than a blank white wall. That was before the virtual backgrounds were working better on Zoom if you didn't have a green screen. So I started using that as a place for giving shiurim. But yet, I actually decided that with that atmosphere around me and having that surface to put down a shender, it actually made a beautiful place to make it a makom kavua for learning and for davening. So we turned our shuls, our homes into shuls in Bate Midrash. We davened at home, we learned at home, whether it was every day or every Shabbos. And one thing that, of course, we came out with here is that really it can be an Oved Hashem anywhere. That it's not just when I come to shul on Shabbos that I'm doing Judaism, but my home is also a place, the place where I am all the time. B'chol drachecha da'ehu, even in all the ways we should know Hashem, even at home, I can do Judaism. I don't know if any of you have ever davened mincha at a rest stop on a long road trip, but it's a little bit of a jarring experience, and you're kind of hoping that, you know, I kind of do it on my phone and try not to shuckle too much, and so I don't look like, you know, that I'm doing anything too strange, and I probably go quickly so that, you know, nobody makes any of it. So it's a little bit of a weird experience. But that experience shows the beauty of having God truly everywhere with us. And that became true in our home, that Hashem wasn't just to be found in the shul, but in the same place that we do everything else that we do in life. And the truth is, I liked davening at home. I really did. First of all, I was always on time. Didn't matter whatever time it was, I was on time. And I could go at my own pace as long as I didn't have to log on to anything. And there was also, it was especially like on a Shabbos morning or Yom Tov morning, it was so quiet at that time. There was a real serenity to it after what turned out to be extremely busy weeks. Shabbos morning davening in my apartment was really wonderful. And at the same time, we also learned how important shul really is. That, of course, the social aspect keeps people connected, and that, you know, barring, you know, other intentional means of getting together, just being able to show up to Shul on Shabbos morning and know other people will be there or on a weekday was something that we really missed and we appreciated. But we also learned that, especially with the social distancing requirements, so Shul didn't turn to the same social, has not yet turned to the same social experience that we expected it to be. And we also learned to return to the primary purpose of Shul, which is for a Jew to pour out their soul to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We must say Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, and we come back to Shul, and I remember the first time that I came back on a weekday afternoon. I think it was an afternoon, the first time we had a minyan. And it was powerful to be able to say Yehishmi Rabba for the first time in close to 3 months. It really was. And that's really the primary purpose of a shul, is to be able to daven, that we have this dedicated space. And it could be that maybe we miss Chazaras HaShatz a little bit less than other things, but davening Betzibor and having those parts where you need a community, it's something that we, that at least speaking for myself, that I really long for, and it was really disconcerting to go that long without having done it, that davening felt somewhat incomplete. Truth is, we are still missing some things, that we still have not yet given aliyahs in the main shul to anybody besides the Baal Kol Reh. And on Rosh Hashanah and this coming Yom Kippur, I've had to ask people to sing softly. And as you might know, I like singing a lot, and not having that part of shul, that even with the limited singing that I'm able to do when I'm a shliach tzibur, I still try to pick faster tunes and to minimize. I missed it a lot. So even now, it feels a little provisional and not the same. And that part of shul is something that I think we've learned to miss, that if coming to shul sometimes seemed like a chore, sometimes it felt a little extra in whatever way. It's an extra responsibility or something that we just kind of got used to. I think we learned the importance of shul. So these are the three major things that I think really impact. Again, everything I'm saying is really just me speaking from my own soul. So I think the three things that really stood out to me that I was thinking about the last couple of weeks in preparing this was that we learned the importance of communal responsibility, that we truly are responsible to one another as a matter of life and death, and that we need leadership, that it doesn't work when we all do things on our own, but when we do see truly great leaders step up, the impact is enormous. And shul is something that's truly important to us. And with that, I pivot to ask, where are we going? What's the future going to hold? So we start with Arevut. What's the world going to look like in being responsible? So I hope that, look, there's a concern, I think, that we often have short-term memories. Even think within the last 6 months, if any of you read Rabbi Dr. Glatz Shlita's last update, and he was talking about some of the irresponsible behavior that we've seen. And he said point blank, have we forgotten what March and April looked like in our communities? And is that where we want to go back? God forbid. And sometimes we do in fact have short-term memories that after we emerge from an experience, we sort of forgot what it was like before and we kind of go back to normal. But I hope that in some ways, there are certain things that hopefully we will preserve and some things that maybe we won't preserve. And one thing that I hope we'll remember after all this is over is Arevut, that we need to continue that sense of responsibility to ourselves and society once more. That we need to do more to move away from a self-centered world. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I think I heard him say this orally once, but I found it in writing. So he said the following at some time. He said, the consumer society was laid down by the late Steve Jobs. And it's not just Steve Jobs. But you'll see it in a second why he singles out Steve Jobs. Coming down the mountain with two tablets, iPad 1 and iPad 2. And the result is that we now have a culture of iPod, iPhone, iTunes, I. When you're an individualist, egocentric culture, and you only care about I, you don't do terribly well. That's something that we've learned before, but Rabbi Sacks said this years ago. And this also applies to the selfie culture that, look, it's sometimes it's convenient to not have to ask somebody else to take a picture and you can take the actual selfie. But obviously when we critique the selfie culture, we're not necessarily critiquing, you know, taking the pictures that you want to have on a memorable vacation, but it's the notion of focusing on ourselves and looking in the mirror and seeing ourselves and looking at the pictures of ourselves. There was a meme that I saw the other day. For those of you on the screen, you'll be able to, is that sharing? Yeah. That kids today want the latest iPhone. I remember wanting this pen with the clickers and the colors. And I think I'll say it's a little bit of a half-truth. I think when I was of that age, whatever that age was, we definitely wanted, I think if my mom is still with us, she can probably attest to the fact that we always wanted Game Boys and PlayStations and the like. But the truth is there was that element there, and you walk into a store and you see those cool pens and you want one, even though they cost $10 and you could get a cheaper pen. That's what people used to want. But it's jarring to me to see that I got my first smartphone when I was 21, I think it was. I was 21, which I realized might sound young, but at that time it actually wasn't even that young. Now there are 8, 9, 10-year-olds that have smartphones, you know, valuable devices that if you break are expensive to replace, and if you lose them, they're expensive to replace. And yet they have them. They have access to the whole world on their fingertips. And while it's true that I think adults also sometimes have a problem having social interactions with their devices in front of them, I think that those of us who grew up without them at least sort of remember what it's like to interact with people not having them. And we kind of know deep down what kind of interaction we want to have. But the use of these devices, the proliferation of these devices is obviously concerning. There was a video from the beginning of the pandemic that was describing, you know, and this was from the beginning of the pandemic, that was describing that, you know, when we come out of this, people will have learned to spend more time with family and have connection to put away their devices. And that might be somewhat true. We did spend more, families did spend more time with each other, those that were home together. But at the same time, we've actually spent more time on these devices. We spend more time on Zoom. Classes right now are on devices. And that's something we have to think about. Are we going to be able to scale back? Are we going to be able to connect in the genuine way, not just through media? And I think another thing when it comes to Arevut, to responsibility, you know, talking about not being self-absorbed, is that the world doesn't revolve around the way I think the rules apply. And right now, to be honest, the whole tri-state area, Scholes and schools are at a crossroad. And the big question that we're asking right now is, are people going to act responsibly? Do I think masks are necessary? Do I think that this whole thing is over? And of course, this is not just individuals, but this is community. But even then, are we looking out for collective interests, or are we thinking about how this affects me? This could be true in all sorts of ways in life. So many different, again, this wasn't just during the pandemic that we had to ask the question of, do I think the rules just apply to me? But obviously that's a question that we're thinking about as we continue to go forward during this period. And something we have to think about going forward is, you know, when a community sets guidelines that are meant to be for the betterment of everybody else, so do I think that I'm the exception? But to pivot a little bit also, we're going to have to think a little bit when it comes to communal responsibility. We're going to have to continue to call people who are alone. And one Kabbalah blee neder I want to make, even when this pandemic is over, is that I will still call the people who aren't coming to shul to wish them a good Shabbos. And that's something we're going to have to think about, that obviously right now we're hyper aware that there's certain people who we normally see who are alone, we have to keep them in mind. But we still are going to have to keep this in mind, that there will be people who are alone even after this is all over. Dr. Erica Brown wrote a beautiful piece in E-Jewish Philanthropy that a couple people sent to me, and I'm grateful. I mean, these were all different sorts of al-chaits, and some of them were focused on the pandemic. But she wrote this powerful line, "For the sin of not calling those who I know who feel most alone, because I didn't want to be reminded of their loneliness." And I thought that was, that really hit me right there, that there are times where perhaps we sort of avoid helping people because we know their situation is so nebuch that we just know it's going to be too much for us to bear. And yet we still have that responsibility. Kol Yisrael Arevin Zeh LaZeh. And even after the pandemic, we will still need to care about those who are both alone because they're physically alone because they can't go anywhere, and alone because they feel alone. They feel existentially alone. We're going to have to do that. And the final area of Arivut that I think we have to think about going forward is also this volunteerism. There's the famous book, Bowling Alone, that talks about how people used to bowl in leagues, and now people just go bowl alone. And it's part of this, again, this emerging society where we do things a little more alone because, ironically, with internet connections, we find our connection through the internet instead of through in-person respect. And this applies to, in a certain way, to volunteering, to contributing to society, that because we're ever absorbed in whatever's going on in our own Arba Amot, that there might be less and less of a sense of giving back to our community. This is something that's discussed in Bowling Alone. I discussed it a little bit, actually. I don't think I addressed that particular angle of it, but something I referenced in my drasha, or something that I discussed in my drasha, one of my drushes to be read on Yom Kippur. But I personally saw during this time how much often needs to get done, whether it's a matter of doing a chesed for somebody or it's taking care of the things that need to get done in order to make sure that we have a viable running community. And certainly after this is all over, we will still need any community will need everybody's participation to help us reach the heights that we want to reach. Okay. Regarding the realm of leadership. So I think one thing for us to think about going forward is cultivating a renewed respect for rabbinic authority. For the sin that we committed by disparaging our parents and our teachers, and morim in the sense of morei halacha, morei derech. And it's easy, this isn't new 2020, but this is sort of new modern society with the ever-growing drive towards personal autonomy, and I know best, and I looked up the source and I know it best, and I read the news and I know it best. And yet at the end of the day, we say Yiftach Bedoro Kishmul Bedoro, that sometimes it doesn't even matter who the leaders are, obviously within reason, but it's important to have leadership. And why is this important? The Ramban explains in Parshat Shoftim, the importance of the mitzvah of looking to authority is that the Torah was given to us in writing. That not everyone is going to agree about everything. And the Torah will become multiple Torahs because there will be a lot of machlokas. Because new things arise and people are going to think about it differently. And that's certainly what we've seen in this era, that there's been a multiplicity of approaches, and sometimes that's okay. But in order to have something that keeps everybody together, that binds us all together, there needs to be some sort of shared direction, shared purpose. And I think one thing in general that the modern Orthodox community needs to think about is the importance of having competent rabbinic leaders who can help us pave a path that's something that we can keep an intact community. That a pasuk from this week's parsha that we're supposed to ask our fathers and they'll tell us, our elders, and they will explain to us. So Mefarshim explained this in the context of historical memory, but in general, it's a matter of seeking guidance. And on the one hand, leaders have to know their expertise and their limitations. And on the other hand, and along with that, real trust must be earned, that there needs to be room for diversity, that it shouldn't be that there's any sort of dictatorship, not in America, not in Judaism. But on the other hand, it's also important to have a sense that we have experts to submit to, and that even if we sometimes think differently, that sometimes, especially as we become a more global community, that there's something beyond me and there's something beyond what I think. And that if we want to keep it one Torah, which in and of itself is a mitzvah, that we have to be willing to do that. So there's this question, who's a leader, who's an expert? It's not easy to resolve, but I believe that the notion that celebrities are influencers, that they have their opinion to offer about what COVID protocol should be or whatever other things are going on in the world, I think is potentially harmful, because we have to know our limitations, we need to know our expertise, and even if we have a platform, we should stick to what we know. And if we're going to say something, we should be really, really sure that it is the right thing. And we will definitely do better to follow during this period the consensus of medical opinions. But that's true in so many other areas of life. Just something for us to be thinking about. Okay, and apparently my battery's running low. I might have to switch to the phone, so bear with me if I have to make a change. And let's finish off talking about returning to Shul. Hashivinu Hashem Elocha v'nashuva. Hashem, return us, and we will return to you. It's a pasuk that comes from Eicha. But we've been saying it in the daily Slichos, and we're going to say it 5 times on Yom Kippur, Haba Aleinu Latova. And we're going to ask Ribono Shel Olam, Shema Koleinu, hear our voice. Chus Rachim Aleinu, have mercy on us. And then, Hashivinu Hashem Elocha v'nashuva. I can't think of a more timely way that applies. That we're begging Ribono Shel Olam to listen to us, to give us a full return to where we are. So first of all, what is tshuva? So Rav Kook talks about how tshuva is not actually about not sinning, but it's about perfection. He says the ethical sense demands justice, and this is an oros of tshuva, the ethical sense demands justice and goodness of person. It demands perfection. But how difficult it is for a person to realize ethical perfection in actuality. And how weak is a person's capacity to direct his actions to the purity of the ideal of total justice? How then will you yearn for something that is not all within the capacity? The answer to this is that tshuva is natural for a person and makes him whole. Tshuva is about going to the natural, I emphasize. Although a person is constantly liable to stumble, cause damage to that which is just and moral, this does not damage his wholeness. That is because the essence of the foundation of perfection is the longing and permanent desire for perfection. And this desire is the basis of tshuva. which is always victorious in a person's pathway in life, which truly perfects him. He goes on to say that tshuva preceded creation. Therefore, it is the foundation of the world. The perfection of life comes from precisely with the ongoing of life's self-revelation in accordance with its essential nature. And therefore, tshuva rectifies the damage and brings the world and life back to its source precisely through the revelation of the foundation of life's supernal essence, which is the world of freedom. So tshuva is not about sin, but it's about looking at the natural state of the world. Hashivinu Hashem, we say in davening, Hashivinu Avinu L'Torah, return us to your Torah, V'karveinu Malkeinu L'Vodatecha, bring us back to your worship, V'achzireinu B'tshuva Shleima L'Fanecha, and bring us back to your full tshuva, Baruch Atah Hashem Harutzeh B'tshuva, Hashem wants our tshuva. And my dear mentor, Rabbi Menachem Penner, on March 15th, the day that his shul stopped davening, the very beginning of this period, so we don't know how long this is going to be, but when we say that bracha, we can think of Rav Kook, that we're not just thinking about this bracha in the context of sin, but about the desire for the way things are supposed to be, the perfection, the natural nature. Hashem should bring us back, and he wants us back. Karveinu Malkeinu Vodatecha, bring us back to tefillah in the Beit Knesset. We will look at the pasuk Hashiveinu Hashem Elocha v'nashuva. The Midrash Lekach Tov says, "V'nashuv k'tiv plomar titein lanu lev v'nashuva, gives a heart and we will return el mitzvotecha, to your mitzvot, v'nashuv l'kavuteinu, we'll go back to where we were before." Just give me a pause for a second. I'm going to transfer my device here. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Midrash Lekach Tov says that it's supposed to return to the way things were before. That's the neshuva we're looking for. Based on the way things were, we want to go back to the way the world was before. And it's all in Hashem's hands. That's why it's Hashiveinu. Hashem has to return us because it is in his hands. And so too the Torah Tmima records the beautiful dialogue. Amar Knesset Yisrael Ibn HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Sha'olam B'yatcha Hi, Hashiveinu. Ribono Sha'olam, it's in your hands, bring us back. Amar Alem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B'yatchem Hu, no, it's in your hands. And then they respond, Amar Lefanav, Ribono Sha'olam B'yatcha Hu, no, it's in your hands. The Kach Ne'amar Hashiveinu Hashem Elocha Neshuva, why is it? Return us and we'll return. At the end of the day, Knesset Yisrael wins. And it's in Hashem's hands, but then we return. And the Torah Tmima, this is based on Midrash, but the Torah Tmima explains here that the tshuva of the Jewish people is both in the hands of Klal Yisrael and in the hands of Kadosh Baruch Hu, meaning that both sides are necessary. Both sides are necessary. We're in the middle of a serious tshuva. We're trying to do tshuva. And if we show a sincere desire to do tshuva, Hashem helps us. And same too here. Return us, Hashem, and we will return. Because we say Hashiveinu, so we're trying to do this, and Hashem will help us return. But El Munishit Sarach Siyu Mishneat Stadim, Lachain Omrim Hashiveinu, Mitzadcha V'Nashuva Mitzideinu. That we need help to do tshuva. On the one hand, it's in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands, and on the other hand, it's in our hands. And in that sense, when it comes to Shul, this is perfectly applicable. First, it's in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. Our full return to Shul, without the masks, without the social distancing, the full Kiddushim, and the singing, It's in Hashem's hands when we can go back to that. But we also have to want it. When the time comes, we're going to have to want it. And right now, in fact, it is murky. There are good reasons for some not to come back. But what will happen when it's truly over? It's in Hashem's hands as to when we will fully return to Shul. But on the other hand, it is in our hands. It is on us to fulfill that vision. So what will the future hold? What normal do we want to come back to? Will davening be short, normal, or long? Will Rosh Hashanah davening be just a few minutes longer than a regular Shabbos was pre-pandemic? 3 hours we were in Rosh Hashanah. Is that what we want? Is that what we don't want? Zoom shiurim. Do we want to continue to learn Torah over Zoom? Or maybe are we going to come back? Are we going to be willing to come back to a shiur in person that is live and not on double speed? What's going to become of Yom HaShoah and Yom HaTzmaut experiences? I heard there was a discussion once in the community that young people weren't coming to Yom HaShoah. And when the rabbis asked, they said, well, if it were online, we would show up. Is that how we're going to commemorate the Holocaust going forward? Is that what it's going to look like? Is that what Yom HaTzmaut? Is that what Yom HaTzmaut's going to look like? As we did this past year. And in some communities, they've had backyard minyanim, black minyanim. And on the one hand, especially right now, I mean, right now, they were, you know, especially when we first started, they were a necessity. Shuls couldn't fit that many people. But it's convenient and it helps me fulfill a particular need. And one thing that we have to do going forward, it's on Jewish communal leaders, Rabbanim, to do, is to make the case for the broader community to still be part of a cohesive community that is larger than just the people on your block and the people who can fit in your basement. Why join a shul? Why continue to be a member of a shul? Why send kids to a local yeshiva when I can do public school and do some online Judaic program? So on the one hand, we must ensure that our homes continue to be a Machne Kodesh. Not a Machne Chadash, although we love Machne Chadash as well, but Machne Kodesh, a holy home. And part of that question is, there's no separation. So what's in and what's out? What culture is coming in? What privacy do we have? What's coming out? What's going out? What people are looking into and listening into what's going on in our homes and what's going out there? What's the work-life balance right now when everything is one space? Another one of Dr. Brown's al-Khayr is for the sin of living at work instead of working from home. It's hard to be an Oved Hashem that way, I find. That when all sort of lumps together, it can be a little bit difficult to be an Oved Hashem. And also to have that separation that when I'm davening, that there could be other things going on. And the same place where I read the news and I watch TV and I play games is the same place I daven. I think that's difficult. And part of this, I believe, is elevating our homes as places of Avodas Hashem and seeing that even when I'm davening at home, my home can be a place for Avodas Hashem. But on the other hand, I believe that when push comes to shove, we're going to have to make the case that Shul must be a center for Judaism. I like the name Queens Jewish Center because it's a Jewish center. It's a center for Judaism. It is a place we go, not that we can't do Yiddishkeit in other places, but when we do things as a community, there's a center for it. And that we're not just individuals looking out for ourselves and we're not on our own, but we're part of something bigger. And we need a dedicated space for tefillah. Our homes can be distracting. As I said, we need a dedicated place. And a backyard or a basement is not a mikdash ma'at. It's not a mikdash ba'at. We still have a concept of Rav Am Hadras Melech, and right now we can't do it. We can't do it. We can't have the Siyum HaShas of 90,000 people right now. We can't have a packed shul on Yamim Noraim. But it's something that we missed, and it's something that I believe we should hope for in the future. I saw an article put forth by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, discussed how Evan Williams, who was the co-founder of Twitter, framed it that convenience decides everything. Convenience decides everything. Convenience seems to make decisions for us, trumping what we like to imagine our true preferences. Easy is better, easiest is best. It goes on, for the sake of time, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it concludes. So let's reflect on the tyranny of convenience. Try more often to resist its stupefying power and see what happens. We must not forget the joy of doing something slow and something difficult, the satisfaction of not doing what is easiest. The consolation of inconvenient choices may not be all that stands between us and a life of total efficient conformity. So even though davening at home is convenient, and davening for those who have that ability to daven in an apartment, that might be more convenient, we have to make the case that that's not necessarily the best. And part of that's asking, what's the shul experience going to look like? Are we going to have that same Rosh Hashanah this past year that we're going to have next year? And I made this point last year in my Shabbos Shuva Drasha when I talked about the length of davening, but I'll make it again. At the end of the day, it's not going to be about how long or short it is, but it's about how meaningful it is. If singing makes davening meaningful, then that's what we need to do. If having a meaningful Dvar Torah is something that's necessary, even if it makes shul a little bit longer, it's something that we need to be willing to do. That if the dignity of shul is preserved by going at a little bit more of a, more moderate pace than fast, that giving out aliyahs and making a mishaberach gives a little bit of a dignity to a shul, then maybe there's a place for that. Being honest, Obdei Hashem, means that we're not just doing it to get out. We come to shul to daven, not to have daven. But at the same time, with all the pre-existing reasons why people have shorter attention spans today, we will have to think about making it shul a meaningful experience, and we have to make that case. And likewise, a shir is a better experience not in front of the screen. I'm sorry, it's been a while. I am almost done. But it's an even better experience. The reason why I'm even where I am right now, I'm inside the shul right now, because I wanted you to sort of have a taste of what it would be like if you were sitting in front of me right now. I'm standing literally in the spot that I would be. And I think that learning is a better experience when we're in person. It's creating community through learning Torah together. And I certainly have a hard time, especially when I'm listening on the phone. It's very hard for me to listen on the phone for a long time. But even with screens, it can be hard to focus. And we use that same device for other things. And how many of us have multitasked while listening to some sort of Zoom call? But when we're in shul, we're just listening to Torah. We are there. We're basking in the Torah. And hopefully that's where we're going back in the future. That hopefully on the one hand, for those who can't access it, those who aren't coming in person, Matova Manaim, the people can listen to online, don't have to miss the experience. But at the same time, some of us are going to have to make that sacrifice, that inconvenient sacrifice, to come to shul for a shir. And yet, the last point, the major point I really want to make, is that shul is not just about Torah and Tefillah. In fact, I was once at a Prabha Shabbos, not for myself, but in a shul that I davened in, I was listening to a candidate speak, and gave the classic thing, what's your vision of a shul? It's a bakum Torah and Tefillah and whatever. And it's true, and I think that's the core of what a shul is. But if we want people to continue to see the need to invest in big shuls, we'll have to make the case that shul is not just about Torah Tefillah, but it's about something much larger about that. It's really about the Jewish people. It's about having a focus point for celebrating Israel and caring about Israel and having a Jewish culture and doing chesed and being a Jewish people, caring about Jewish unity and talking about that and being a center for place in crisis. And we have to realize that what held communities together before the pandemic is that they already existed. Yes, Schultz did a lot of creative programming over Zoom, whether it was having Kabbalah Shabbos over Zoom, Havdalah over Zoom, Shirim over Zoom. Okay, so we adapted that way. There were even more creative programs, youth programs that Schultz did. The ability to have on our end that we were able to have an APAC program, whether it's a coffee talk, something like that. There was creative programming that went on. But suppose that this one went on for 5 or 10 years. What would shul look like? What would our community look like? We would have very few connections, because when we show up in person, when we actually come to shul, even if it's just as part of davening or whether it's for another kind of program, we're making those connections. And we don't even realize it, or we may not realize it, but what's been keeping the shul together right now is that we just had to, we're just suspending this for a finite amount of time, but support systems would not hold up if not for being able to come back to shul. That the notion that people are eventually going to have to gather in some place, and it can't just be the people on my block, but it has to be a whole community. That's what creates a network that that enables the Jewish people to do the work that we need to do in supporting people, in creating meaningful Jewish experiences for a larger community. There's so much more that we're able to do when with the power of numbers, and we need people in order to do that. We need to meet new people and continue to cultivate relationships. I don't know if you realize, but Zoom is one of the, if there's one thing that's horrible about Zoom, it's a worse place to socialize. Because you come on, and first of all, if you're coming for a shiur, maybe it's a little talk before, but only one person can talk at a time. If you ever try to go on some sort of social program on Zoom, and I have, it's very canned. People maybe have a chance to go around and say something. Zoom is a worse place to make connections and to build relationships. There's a lot that we can do over it. There's a lot we've been able to do to keep the show running. It's the worst place to cultivate relationships. And Dr. Ron Wolfson, who is an expert in thinking about creating welcoming synagogue environments, he writes, it's all about relationships. It's not about programs. It's not about branding, labels, logos, clever titles, websites, or smartphone apps. It's not even about institutions. It's about relationships. And that is why we need real shuls in the future. That the block minyanim, the apartment minyanim might be convenient. Davening at home might be convenient. Listening to shiur online is convenient. But if we continue to live that way, just that way, all the time going forward, it's not going to work. We're going to need to come to shul together. We're going to need to be here in person, because that's how we're going to cultivate relationships, both with each other in order to support each other, to be with each other, because that's ultimately how we are connected. That's how we will stay connected. And it's also, of course, can't forget the relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, this is the dedicated space. This is the Mikdash Me'ah. This is what he envisioned as a spot for us to having a relationship. So, my deep and most fervent prayer this Yom Kippur, Hashivinu Hashem Elecha v'Nashuva, bring us to a full return. If you give us the opportunity, we'll do it. And I hope that everybody is with me in getting back to that return. And one thing I will emphasize is that we're not back until we're all back in Mir Tashem. In the near future, we will all be back together. We'll be able to have the shul experience like we did before. So these are some of my thoughts and reflections on COVID, where we've been, where I hope we'll go to the future, the things we need to think about. And the very last thing I just want to say at this time, because I'm not going to see everybody tomorrow, is that, you know, oftentimes somebody might get up social media and a speech and say, I ask Mechila for anybody who I might have hurt this past year. And I hold by that message, but I like the way that one particular person posted it the other day on social media, is that getting up and saying, I ask for Mechila doesn't go very far. But in the 1 year that I've been your rabbi, I hope that if at any point I shortchanged you, if I insulted anybody, if I fell short in any of my responsibilities, I'm not asking you mechila in this public way, but I hope that you will let me know if I did something and didn't apologize for it, so that we can make amends. So with that, I wish everybody a gemar chasima tova and a shavua tov.
Thank you so much. That was fantastic.
Yes, shavua tov.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you so much, Rabbi. Kol hakavod.